Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both the Saturday Show and the Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
Hello, everyone. It is 4 o'clock in the East. I'm Chris Jansing. We hope to get Nicole Wallace to you very shortly. But in the meantime, so much going on. Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, who was arrested yesterday at a voting rights protest at the U.S. Capitol, issued this statement. I stand in solidarity with black women and allies across the country in defense of our constitutional rights to vote. We have come too far and fought too hard to see everything systematically dismantled and restricted by those who wish to silence us. Be assured, this is just the beginning. This is our power, our message. Beatty isn't the only Democratic lawmaker sounding the alarm this week. As we've been reporting, the delegation of Texas lawmakers remains in the nation's capital, pressing for something, in their own words, anything on voting rights. But here's the blunt and ugly and tragic truth. It isn't working. The Washington Post reports that while many Democrats insist that passing a voting rights bill remains a top priority in the coming weeks, Schumer and others have said failure is not an option. Momentum on Capitol Hill has palpably shifted away from the voting rights push following a failed test vote last month and toward Democrats' vast spending plans. The dynamics were on display Wednesday when President Biden arrived at the Capitol for his first in-person lunch with the Senate Democratic Caucus, a meeting that was largely devoted to the massive multi-trillion-dollar climate and safety net plan, not to breaking a voting rights stalemate months in the making. And on Thursday, a contingent of Texas Democrats emerged from a meeting with one key senator, Joe Manchin III, Democrat of West Virginia, without securing any new concessions that would allow a voting bill to pass the Senate in the coming weeks. There's no movement on the filibuster. There's no meeting we're aware of to hammer out the details of a narrower bill. There's no progress whatsoever. In fact, the fastest, most egregious erosion of voting rights in America, which is happening on President Biden's watch, is becoming the new thoughts and prayers issue in the Democratic Party. It's a crisis. It's the greatest threat to democracy in modern history. According to Democrats, the plan is there is no plan. So here we are, with the Republican rollback of access to the polls speeding through more than a dozen states, 28 new restrictive laws already passed and signed into law this year, 18 more states deliberating bills that would restrict access to the polls. And on top of all that, in Georgia, Arizona, and Nevada, candidates who believe the election was stolen are challenging the secretaries of state who stood up for the 2020 election results. It's a crisis that endangers the Democratic majorities in the House and Senate and the prospect of future Democratic candidates winning the White House. And over on the delusional right of American politics, Republicans are still working to undo Joe Biden's legitimate, verified win in the 2020 election. The ex-president calling on Arizona to decertify Joe Biden's win there. After a briefing to the state Senate on the so-called election audit that was filled with so much misinformation, so many falsehoods, that Maricopa County supervisors were forced to fact-check it publicly on Twitter. The unfortunate success of the GOP's voter suppression drive as it collides with stalled Democratic action is where we start today. The Reverend Al Sharpton is here, host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network. Also, Clint Watts, former consultant to the FBI Counterterrorism Division and an MSNBC national security analyst, and Anna Palmer, co-founder of Punchbowl News, as well as an MSNBC contributor. So great to see all of you here. You know, Reverend Al, when you think about the Texas folks who are still in Washington willing to walk out twice, and you look at the women yesterday who were willing to get into good trouble, as we think of 1 year ago tomorrow when John Lewis passed, the courage, the intensity, But will it matter? Will it make a difference? Where do you think we are right now, Rev?
I think it will make a difference. Last Thursday, when we met with President Biden, leaders of 8 national civil rights groups, and said that we needed him to make this a bully pulpit issue, and he went Tuesday and did so in Philadelphia. I was there. I think the thing that people are not considering is that the Senate Bill 1, which we do not have the votes for, but then you have the John Lewis voter bill, which has not even been completely written and put through the House. What the Democrats need to do is say to Manchin, Sinema, and some of the Republicans, and we've met the civil rights leadership with Manchin and some of the Republicans, let's finish the bill together. What will you pass? Make them say we will do nothing for voter rights, or these are the things that we add. But we keep talking about the John Lewis bill like it's complete and it's passed the House. The option is, if you say there's some things in the Senate bill, one you didn't like, what are they and what can we do with the John Lewis bill? Or let's expose clearly that you are just for the erosion of voting rights. We've got to force them to the wall on this. Let us remember, Chris, that is how the generation ahead of me got the Voting Rights Act in the first place in 65. It didn't take one session. It didn't take one meeting. It didn't take one set of arrests. It took multiple strategies, multiple coming together, multiple times. This is a struggle. This is not a political campaign. And I think that we're prepared to do that. That's why there are continued civil disobedience acts being planned, rallies that will culminate in a national march that we all are involved in on August 28th in Washington. And people say, why late August? Because there is no John Lewis bill completed yet, and it has to go before the House and the Senate late in the session.
You know, when you look at what the Texas lawmakers are doing, you get a real sense that they feel like, okay, we've been talking about this for generations, but there is an urgency to this because the attacks are coming fast and furious right now. I want to read something that the Associated Press wrote about the long, surreal days of Texas lawmakers. The more than 50 state legislators find themselves balancing a punishing schedule of political lobbying, outside work, and family obligations, all under a national spotlight. Many have left young children behind. The Texas state legislature is a part-time body with an annual salary of $7,200. So the vast majority of the delegates have other primary jobs back in Texas that they abruptly left behind. Anna Palmer, is the sense of urgency we're seeing from these Texas lawmakers something you're seeing and feeling on Capitol Hill?
Listen, I think they put a fine point on it and actually put that pressure, that human pressure of meetings with a lot of Senate Democrats. You saw that they were meeting with Vice President Kamala Harris. So it certainly is something that kind of Democrats are having to face in Congress. But I don't think that there is the sense of urgency. I think that when you look at Democrats and the fact that they know that their majority is so slim, and most believe the House will turn in the midterms, as it historically does, that they are really looking towards infrastructure, trying to find that budget resolution, do some of these once-in-a-generation things that President Joe Biden has set forth. Right now, no one is saying that they're ready to get rid of the filibuster over this in terms of the key people that you would need, the Joe Manchins of the world. He reiterated once again this week he was not interested in that.
So, Anna, let me just interrupt you there and ask you, then, is this a choice? Is this a choice? If we're going to get infrastructure done, we can't do this, too. We have to prioritize. And here's where the priority is. What's behind all of it?
Well, I think they see a pathway forward on infrastructure and potentially that budget reconciliation deal. Whereas on voting rights, I think to the Reverend's point, potentially this S3, the John Lewis voting rights bill, which is still being written, could be that piece of legislation that could people come together. But it's very difficult to see 10 Republicans at this point vote for anything on voting rights. I think that that is going to be a real hurdle that they're going to have to face. And that even with these Democratic lawmakers in town for the next several weeks, I don't see that that is the tipping point here.
Let me go to Nicole Wallace, who is back with us now. We had a little bit of technical difficulty, but it's good to see you, my friend.
I heard you and I thought, oh, you, my glorious, magical, brilliant friend, Chris Jansing, reading something I wrote hours ago and delivering it like such a maestro.
And wrote brilliantly, by the way.
If people only knew how brilliant you are. I mean, look, I came to this conclusion after talking to, I mean, Anna's got this story down, and what she's reporting is spot on. And the Rev is right about the size and scope and duration of the sort of struggle. The only thing I bring to the table is my intimate knowledge of the depths of the Republicans' commitment to rolling back voting rights in all 48 states where they've introduced bills. And I'm scared of the speed and efficiency with which they're passing. And, you know, I guess my question is always to the Rev, you know, is it enough? Do you have enough time to make this a front burner issue for Democrats? Or are there such slim margins in the House and Senate that we don't have a cycle to let this become a front burner issue legislatively?
I think that time we do have. I think the time is that you must fight and you must continue to keep the pressure on as you go through into August, because clearly with the John Lewis bill not written, I'm not looking at the 10 senators that you need Republican. What I'm looking at is that what can you say to Sinema and Manchin to say that if we can put these things in the bill and without messing with the core rights that we need, then can we fight to have a workaround the filibuster, which we have in other areas, and put it on them? Because let's face it, if the Democrats lose this narrow majority, Manchin and Sinema are in minority parties. Sinema may lose her seat. So you may not care about the civil and voting rights, but do you care about yourself? You can bring a bill that they can live with where you have 50 solid and say, now we want to propose a workaround and make the Republicans have to deal with the fact that they've worked around before, they've done it, and they do it now. I think that rather than our becoming full of despair, we must be strategic and we must look to history. If you can work around for some things, you can work around on voting rights. Sit down at the table with us, Joe Manchin and Senator Sinema, and tell us what we need to do to get you part of that workaround. And let's go ahead and debate that with the Republicans. That's a debate many of us would welcome.
You know, Chris, you mentioned the Texas Democrats. I think that they are in some ways making the Washington Democrats look bad. They're willing to sacrifice personally. A lot of them left young children at home. I know you just read some of that new Washington Post reporting. They're willing to sacrifice professionally. They're willing to sacrifice reputationally. They're willing to sacrifice their standing in a state where Democrats have a hard enough time. And I think it's that contrast this week. And obviously, the chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus getting arrested yesterday. I think what is shaping up here in the dog days of summer is this sharp contrast between how important this is to people who see the stakes and see this as front burner, and the more maybe pragmatic analysis that you were talking about, Chris, to get infrastructure and other policy priorities done.
Yeah, part of it is obviously, and I've spent a lot of time in those states. I've spent time watching the way the Democrats in Texas are operating, where other states where voting rights are under attack. I've met with the people and covered the people who have formed entire organizations trying to convince people of why voting for state legislatures is so important and the impact it can have. They also understand, right, that that's sort of the long game. I was talking in the last hour about being in Mississippi and Alabama, and an extraordinary group of Black women who consider themselves following the footsteps of Stacey Abrams. And one part of it is they want to get more Black women elected. They want to get a more representative Congress. They want to get a more representative legislature. But there is an urgency that they're willing to put their lives aside because they understand you cannot get to that place. You cannot get to that place of fairness, of equity, until you have the right to go and cast a ballot. And Rev understands this better than anyone, but I am deeply moved by the number of Blacks who come up to me who are older than even you and I, Rev, who will talk about what they have fought for over the decades and how they are looking and seeing it slipping away state by state by state. This urgency that they feel on the ground, that they feel in their own lives, that they feel when they look at the futures of their children, drives them in a way that is incredible. And there is without a doubt, whether you look at Texas or any of the other states, there is a difference between what's happening at that very grassroots level and what we see as the prioritizing on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, I mean, Rev, I wonder what you think about that. I mean, there is, Rachel says, watch what they do, not what they say, right? I mean, what they're doing, I mean, Anna's reported exactly what they're doing. They're doing the bipartisan infrastructure deal. They're getting the human infrastructure pieces done through reconciliation. They do not have this as a achievable agenda item. How does that land?
Well, I think that, first of all, you must understand, as we are watching these states stack up these restriction laws, one federal law would override all of that, which is why we Right. must remain focused in the voting rights community and the civil rights community. Secondly, I think that what we need to deal with, I understand from some people that the White House may be saying, let us get infrastructure through and other things through before we have the fight around the work around with voting rights. And as we write the John Lewis bill, again, to have the fight now when the bill is not even there and passed the House would be premature. And lastly, to Chris, right. I'm old, but I'm not cold. I'm going to be fired up all summer.
I want to bring you in, Clint Watts, because the other piece of the Republican effort, and we've spent a lot of time talking about this, is you know, it may be malevolent, but it is an incredibly competent and fast-moving strategy. It is anti-democratic, and it's zipping through the states. But the other piece of it is part of the radicalization of the ex-president's supporters, and those are the faux audits. There's one in Maricopa County, Arizona, that we've talked about a whole lot. The ex-president was tweeting about it yesterday, and now they're calling for the current president, President Biden's victory there, to be decertified. This is the next front of their efforts to delegitimize him. And I wonder at the intersection of lies about election fraud and extremism, how that lands from your perspective.
Yeah, Nicole, you know, the first story of Texas is if you can't win the voters, you get rid of the voters. And in Arizona, if you can't win the vote, then you try and change it. And you see this, it's in Texas and Arizona. What do we see? These are places where the GOP just doesn't have good ideas and they can't win. And so when you can't win, you try and change the story. The problem is when you change the story, even when people who know the story is a lie try and change the story, someone believes it. Someone down the road is committed to that cause. And every single time they do this, there will be someone that believes that the election was stolen, and you will see mobilizations to violence. If you just look in the last 3 to 4 days, the number of arrests around the country of people that want to strike political targets that are talking about turning over the election, DNC headquarters in California, we got new revelations about that, another arrest out in San Francisco, talking about explosives and weapons. Each one of these lies powers a conspiracy. That conspiracy, the longer it lives, the more it's perpetuated, and the more political leaders speak to that lie, the more you will see people mobilized to violence over time. Ultimately, what I never hear from the GOP in any of these discussions or with regards to these conspiracies is the long-term damage it does to America. Never do they talk about how do we bring the country together. How do we make sure that we get people to vote and we understand what voters need? What's a strategy for building confidence in democratic institutions? That's it. That should be our number one goal, regardless of party. They are undermining all of these things. And I think the extremism part is the most concerning. And as the weeks go on and as the president becomes more vocal and out in public, you will see more and more incitement and mobilization of violence over time.
Yeah. And Anna Palmer, I've often wondered, I mean, there's a rigidity to where things are up there. Is that a fair description of it, to where the filibuster stands, where the objections to doing away with it? But I've always thought that the security piece could change the landscape, could change the ground underneath their feet. Now, that might sound foolish in light of the fact that hang Mike Pence was the mission statement of the insurrection and it changed not one thing. But it certainly puts Liz Cheney front and center again in talking about Donald Trump and his supporters and his followers as a threat to Homeland Security. And I wonder if there are any concerns when you see these arrests in Sacramento at the Democratic headquarters there.
I think lawmakers, particularly Democrats, are on high notice in terms of their own personal safety. We are going through a massive fight right now that we are watching about Congress and actually funding the Capitol Police, which are on track to run out of money by the middle of August. These are the people that keep the Capitol safe. We had most recently the fences coming down, which was something we all, as people who work in the building, were very thrilled about. And I think a lot of the country was excited about. But it means it puts into kind of sharp focus this concept of their own personal safety. But time and time again, whether it is January 6th, or you look back in history when Steve Scalise was shot, when you look at what happened with Gabby Giffords, and violence even against members, is sometimes you think, oh, maybe that will shift the debate all of a sudden when their own personal safety is a concern. But it really hasn't. The parties are very far apart right now. I think distrust is huge. And we don't even know if House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy is going to even name Republicans to that select committee. That is why I think Liz Cheney is going to be so important for Democrats moving forward. It means that they can do it. And it also means that she's going to be a real clear voice on this issue.
Chris Janzing, you are majestic as a broadcaster and just as a friend and colleague. You are in a league of your own. Thank you so much for stepping in there for me into the breach.
My pleasure.
I'm so grateful. My thanks to the Reverend Al Sharpton and Anna Palmer. Thank you both so much. Clint Watts is sticking around. There's one more thing for us to cover before we take our first break. Yesterday at this hour, we started with new reporting and revelations from the yet-to-be-released book by Washington Post Pulitzer Prize winners Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker. Specifically, their harrowing new reporting about then-Vice President Mike Pence's experience on January 6th. We read this excerpt from their new book. Here it goes again. Quote, after a team of agents scouted a safe path to ensure the Pences would not encounter trouble, Geibels and the rest of Pence's security detail guided them down a staircase to a secure subterranean area that rioters couldn't reach, where the vice president's armored limousine waited. Geibels asked Pence to get in one of the vehicles. Quote, we can hold here, he said. I'm not getting in the car, Tim, Pence replied. This is the important part. Quote, I trust you, Tim, but you're not driving the car. If I get in that vehicle, you guys are taking off. I'm not getting in the car, end quote. The Pences then made their way to a secure underground area to wait out the riot. After reading that exact excerpt yesterday, I asked Jeremy Bash this question, quote, someone familiar with this reporting, Jeremy Bash, tells me that Pence feared a conspiracy, feared that the Secret Service would aid Trump in his ultimate aims that day. This is the most harrowing version of Mike Pence's day that I've seen reported out, end quote. This is me today. I interviewed those sources again hours ago today. They stand by that reporting, pointing to this quote from Pence in the book. I'll read it one more time. Quote, I trust you, Tim, but you're not driving the car. If I get in that vehicle, you guys are taking off. I'm not getting in that car, end quote. To both the excerpt and my reporting, an aide to former President Mike Pence is responding and today says that, quote, any characterization that Pence was mistrustful of the Secret Service or its plans for him is a total misinterpretation of Pence's comments. Quote, this couldn't be more wrong, end quote. That new book from Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker, striking lots of nerves. When we come back, the CDC is warning of an upcoming pandemic of the unvaccinated, as healthcare officials plead with Americans to not just get the shot, but to stop spreading COVID disinformation. Myths is the latest threat to public health coming up. Plus, a reckoning this week for the lawyers who peddled the big lie on behalf of the ex-president. We'll talk with one state attorney general who's going to make sure that everyone who shopped those lies is held accountable. Plus, investigators prosecuting January 6th, more inclined to prosecute and take down domestic terrorism cases. We'll bring you the latest scare on what was being plotted. We've mentioned it already. It's in California. All those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris Hayes. This week on my podcast, Why Is This Happening? We're back with another installment of our special series with Pod 2024, The Stakes. I'm talking to experts about both Joe Biden and Donald Trump's records on specific policy areas during their time as president. This week, economist Kim Clausing on taxes.
Underfunding the IRS really serves the interest of dishonest people at the top rather than your typical worker who would benefit from being able to get their questions answered and getting their returns processed in a quick way.
That's this week on Why Is This Happening? Search for Why Is This Happening wherever you're listening right now and follow.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
On COVID misinformation, what's your message to platforms like Facebook?
They're killing people. I mean, it really, look, the only pandemic we have is among the unvaccinated. And they're killing people.
Powerful words from the president. That was President Biden just this afternoon responding to a question there from our colleague, Peter Alexander, on the dangers of COVID misinformation spreading in that instance on Facebook. His grave warning comes after the U.S. Surgeon General yesterday issued his first formal advisory to declare this, that the lies are an urgent threat to public health, criticizing tech and social media companies for not doing enough to fight it on their platforms. COVID cases have doubled in the last 3 weeks. A pandemic of the unvaccinated is what the CDC director also called it today. The White House says the facts are now, quote, a matter of life and death. Joining our conversation, Jonathan Lemire, White House reporter for the Associated Press and an MSNBC political analyst. Clint Watts is back. You know, Jonathan Lemire, we all watched this in slow motion, right? The ex-president lying about COVID the whole time, lying about how damaging it was, it is, even after the fact. This president has done an extraordinary sort of human logistical thing, getting needles and vaccines into everyone who's able and willing. But what he's up against now really is the damage left behind by his predecessor.
Yeah, and it's a deeply frustrated President Joe Biden and his staff about the pockets of this country that refuse to get vaccinated. There, at this point, anyone who wants a vaccine has access to one. That's no longer an issue. That was early in the pandemic, no longer. And now, certainly, there are some people who are hesitant, who public health officials can still believe that can be convinced, can be told, like, look, we know this vaccine is developed quickly, but it's safe. We'll show you why you can. We'll make it very easy for you to get. And so there's still some hope there. And of course, children. People are still waiting for a vaccine to be approved for those under 12. But setting all those aside, there is still a pocket of people, and polling shows they are largely Republicans who are refusing to take this vaccine. Some young adults as well. Those young adults might feel like they don't need it because they're invincible. But for those Republicans, it's because it's become a political statement. And certainly there's been an anti-science strain sort of undergirding the parts of the Republican Party for quite some time now that even predates Donald Trump. But he's certainly accelerated it. And we heard from him just undermining trust in all sorts of government institutions throughout his time in office, even before the pandemic. That adds up. His lies parroted by the conservative media, his followers willing to believe anything he says and distrust anything the mainstream media or public health officials or Democrats say. And then, of course, when the virus does arrive and the president downplayed it day after day after day, that adds up too. And he's never, even though he has now started saying to his followers, hey, take the vaccine, he's never given it a full-throated endorsement. And frankly, it may be too late. At this point, it's part of people's political identity to say they won't take this vaccine. It's amplified on social media, and it is holding back vaccination rates across the country as this very contagious variant spreads.
And that is where we are. I want to spend one more minute on where we are. And this was so interesting, Clint Watts. This is Jen Psaki. I'm sure this wasn't news to you, but explaining where the vast majority of disinformation comes from. Let's watch her. We'll talk on the other side.
There's about 12 people who are producing 65% of anti-vaccine misinformation on social media platforms. All of them remain active on Facebook, despite some even being banned on other platforms, including Facebook, ones that Facebook owns.
So, Clint, was Facebook can't take down 12 people who are spreading 65% of the lies about COVID?
Yeah, Nicole, part of the challenge is they're policing content. You know, they don't necessarily police people. And that's where the breakdown in all this comes, whether it's the election last year or COVID-19 last year or vaccines this year. There's way too much focus on trying to police bad content. Look, people can make disinformation, misinformation faster than it can be policed. And that's why they're always beating these social media companies across the board. Separately, though, a lot of these groups have moved into a private fashion. So it's much more difficult to detect who they are. They also know how to skirt around it. While I thought, by the way, I thought the Surgeon General's report yesterday was the best government document I've seen on misinformation and disinformation ever put out by the U.S. government. It was really excellent. Lots of great recommendations. However, from a research perspective, what the press secretary said is absolutely correct. Usually about 1% of the manipulators make about 90% of the nonsense. That's across almost anything. So you really got to focus at the top of the cone, the top of the pyramid. If you can really focus on those individuals that are creating outright lies that are dangerous to public safety, that's critical. There are two things I'd like to add, Nicole. One, from the social media companies across the board, they don't know what to police because the regulations just aren't there. And they're either getting beat up by Section 230 and free speech on the political right or about misinformation, disinformation on the political left. So that they're in this constant twist about what to do.
I want to read from this excellent government report. We don't hear that very often, but it was pretty riveting. This is sort of...
I know, it was really good.
You threw me for a minute, but I've got it. So I'm going to read this to you, Jonathan Lemire, because more than any other area, this is a White House that has a plan. And this is a White House that seems to always have a plan B and a plan C. And it appears this is their, break glass when you come up against the COVID disinformation on the vaccination pace. So this is what it says. Teachers, Murthy said, should explain lessons on media literacy and critical thinking. Journalists, he suggested, should work to responsibly debunk health misinformation without inadvertently spreading it further. Public health professionals should do a better job answering questions and explaining why public health guidelines sometimes change based on new information. As for everyday Americans, they should verify questionable health information with trusted sources. It sounds like the mass communications part of this may be over. And what the government is doing is directing, again, this is targeted around the hesitant, the scared, the maybe sort of straddling the middle of the information streams back to their pediatricians, back to their sort of own personal spheres of influence. Is that the White House strategy, Jonathan?
Yeah, it is. And certainly media literacy is a major problem in this country and has been for a long time. And it's only gotten worse here as people don't understand who they can believe and who they can trust. But in terms of a strategy, that's right. White House is trying to do this on two tracks. Look, they're not eliminating the idea of the big gesture, right? President Biden is still going to say, hey, you should get the vaccine. We saw I was there at the White House this week when pop star Olivia Rodrigo came in and she spoke to the reporters in the briefing room and she's cut a bunch of videos. They're going to be on TikTok. Those are for young Americans, perhaps, who don't think they need the vaccine. And she's trying to convince them, yes, you do, to preserve yourself, but also your loved ones who you might spread the virus to. But they're also doing that. They're trying to do the really granular at the community level, trying to empower, whether it's pediatricians or community leaders, civic groups, pastors, whoever it might be, a person of some authority and trust in a community to say to people like, look, I understand you're confused, you're scared. Maybe you don't always trust or believe what you hear from Washington, but I'm trying to tell you this is good. You can do this. I've done it myself. You should take the vaccine. They are hopeful. Look, they're not giving away the stunts, right? There's going to be things at ballparks and NASCAR races and at grocery stores, but they're also going to try to do small things too, basically trying to flood the zone, because what is the backdrop of all of this is a real worry. We are seeing mass recommendations go back in place in major cities like Los Angeles and Las Vegas. We are seeing the spread of this virus right now, mostly in those red states, but their fear it could be elsewhere. They realize that right now is a moment to try to get ahead of this before weather starts getting colder and viruses start spread even more easily.
Yeah. And I mean, Clint, this brings me back to where we connect in the last block. I mean, with the virus levels, I don't know that we call them surging yet, but they're I think they're doubled since last week. They're largely in red states where the percentage of the vaccinated is at the lowest end for our country. But again, mask mandates are now part of the political hot war, if you will. I mean, COVID restrictions were also named, along with lies about the election result, as being an animating ideology for the current domestic violent extremism threat in this country. And I wonder what concerns you have from a security standpoint if public health experts want us to go back to indoor mask mandates or other public health measures.
Nicole, I think it will tip off a whole series of protests, mobilizations, and violence if we have to go back to that. I mean, my home state of Missouri is ravaged with it right now. They have their surge. It's essentially what happened in New York for us last year. There it's just out of control. And I don't know how they would be able to actually institute those controls again. I really don't. And even in the Northeast and on the West Coast, as they start to push these controls, you will immediately see a reaction. There's another horizon coming to fold, which is the vaccination of small children. When that issue comes to fold, that will bring together lots of anti-vax audience. These are anti-vax audiences over the last decade that are predominantly political left. You'll have the GOP supporters who just refuse to move in that direction. That will become a really hot flashpoint, and this will all converge really as we head into the fall when the country has to get back on its feet. If I could, you know, mention anything from that report that I would emphasize more than things like literacy is great, it's going to have a marginal return at best. You have to scale truth. We have to take messages of truth on the offensive. I think that's the first part, and they did address that in the report. I think the second part is we are moving from the tactical, you know, information or strategic information campaigns, the very tactical ones. We need to be doing messenger judo, as I would say, which is you've got to go into the social media and on the ground and have messengers that look like and talk like these targeted audiences that are just refusing the vaccine. That's physicians. That's you know, ideological leaders, thought leaders. This is people that are trusted in communities. We got to get their message out. They're the social media influencers we need to help on a national level. We got to bring them together in a network to really get this going. And I think the last thing is fear travels faster than calm. And we need to be, you know, not trying to coax people nicely. We need to be telling them this should be a real fear for you. If you're unvaccinated, your chance of dying is astronomically higher than any complication of the vaccine. You are literally at this point, if you're dying of COVID-19 and you're unvaccinated, that is a choice. It really doesn't make sense at this point that you can't take these basic mitigation methods. And it's not just about you. It's about our whole country. If you want our country back on our feet, you don't want to wear a mask come fall, you want kids in school, all you got to do is get a vaccine. You can get it very quickly.
You just said something that is going to become my mantra every day from here on forward. We have to scale truth. That's amazing. That is exactly a mission statement for all of us. Jonathan Lemire, you do that every day. Thank you, my friend, for spending some time with us. Clint, you're sticking around a little longer after that. Up next for us, Michigan is opening an investigation into those who have pushed false claims about the 2020 election result. Why that state's attorney general does not plan on letting those individuals get away with it. Michigan's Dana Nessel will be our next guest. Don't go anywhere. Since November, a team of lawyers shamelessly led by Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell have been trumpeting the big lie about election fraud, attempting to prove that somehow the 2020 election was rigged. It was not. We know it was the most secure election in our country's history and that President Joe Biden was rightfully elected president by big margins. And they're finally being forced to confront all the lies they told. This week in Michigan, a federal judge pressed those lawyers over their lawsuit and the surrounding paperwork seeking to overturn the results of the election, with the judge announcing that she will rule on discipline for these lawyers in the coming weeks. The state of affairs in Michigan is just one of several states looking to actually hold these people accountable for spreading the big lie, at least in court. Joining us now is Michigan's Attorney General, Dana Nessel. Madam Attorney General, thank you for spending some time with us. I've heard from things that you've said publicly and things that Attorney General Josh Shapiro has said that there will be accountability. There is a slow process to seeing that come to fruition. Is that what we're starting to see with Judge Parker in Michigan?
Well, I definitely think so, and I hope so. You know, it's we know already what the impact has been of these lies that were told in a court of law, and then, of course, repeated by the former president and his supporters. And, you know, it's done incredible damage to our democracy, and it's undermined our system of elections. But the one place that seemingly has held up is in our courthouses, because we know that every judge that evaluated these claims, whether they were appointed by a Democrat or a Republican, you know, found these claims to be specious and dismissed these cases. And it's time for these attorneys that filed these ludicrous claims and these vexatious pleadings to be held accountable.
What are your concerns about the damage that's already been done, not just by the lies that were told in court, but the lies that were told to millions of the ex-president's supporters? They're obviously fueling voter suppression laws. They're trying to change who certifies and counts the votes. What does that look like in Michigan?
Well, firstly, it's going to be very hard for people to come to grips with the fact that these lies that they've been told over and over, and they continue to be told every day, seemingly nonstop, that those have been inaccurate claims and that our elections actually are safe and secure. And in Michigan, we had the most successful election that we've ever had, and we know that it was done properly and accurately. But it's going to be hard for folks to be to understand that after everything they've heard. Worse, we're starting to lose some of the individuals that we really need in order to be able to conduct our elections. We have people that just don't want to be clerks anymore. They are retiring and resigning in mass numbers because they don't want to be threatened. They don't want their families to be threatened. And they know that there's just no doing their job right unless they come up with the result that a certain individual or a certain party would like.
And you are fighting this fight, obviously, for accountability. But it's not, you know, on the other side, it's all part of the political mosh pit. Do you feel safe? Do you face threats for doing your job?
Almost every day. And it's not just me. It's a number of individuals that were elected to serve. To serve the public and appointed individuals. It's judges. As I said, it's clerks. It's literally everyone and anyone that seems to stand in the way, of the notion, the ridiculous and false notion that Trump was actually the winner of our election here in Michigan. So it is indeed a scary time, but I think it's why it is so incredibly important that in the one place that we know that people can be held accountable, which is in our courts of law, that we make every effort to make sure that that is actually done. And I will say in my many decades of practice, in front of some of these same judges, including Judge Parker, I have never in my career ever seen pleadings of this sort that were so baseless and inaccurate and unsupported by facts or law. And, you know, unless these attorneys are really held accountable, when I say that, I don't mean just fined. I don't mean just sanctioned. I don't mean just having to pay the expenses or the attorney's fees of their opposing party. I mean, these attorneys have to be disbarred because otherwise they're making so much money off of these cases. There's really no incentive for them to stop doing exactly what they're doing right now. So they have to be penalized in a way where they're actually losing their law license so that never again can they enter a court of law and make these type of unsupported and frankly dangerous claims.
We were riveted by the reporting, and I'll put you on the spot and ask that next time there's a development, we can talk to you about it. It does seem like they're finally being asked some very pointed questions about exactly what you're describing. Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel, thank you so much. Please stay safe. Thank you for spending some time with us to talk about all of this. Up next for us, citing the need to prevent further acts of domestic terrorism, U.S. prosecutors are asking for a prison sentence for the first felony defendant in the January 6th Capitol insurrection. How that could impact more than 100 others facing charges as well is next.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
The first felony defendant to be sentenced in the January 6th Capitol attack is on Monday, and it could set the bar for how at least 100 other defendants are punished. Prosecutors are urging a federal judge to impose an 18-month prison term on 38-year-old Paul Hodgkins. He carried a Trump flag into the well of the Senate on January 6th, prosecutors citing the need to deter domestic terrorism. Separately, other extremism threats continue to be investigated in this country in the wake of January 6th. Two men have been charged in what the FBI calls a, quote, specific, detailed, and serious plan to plot to attack Democratic Party headquarters in Sacramento, California. DOJ says the two began planning to attack Democratic targets after the election and sought support from a militia group in hopes their actions would start a movement. Let's bring into our conversation Ryan Riley, HuffPost senior justice reporter, and Clint Watts is still with us. Ryan, take me through how closely other defendants and defense attorneys are watching this first sentencing.
Very closely. I mean, it's going to lay out the path for a lot of these cases going forward. And the sentence they requested is smack dab in the middle of the sentencing guidelines, 18 months. That's right in the middle of the range of what it would be. And what prosecutors talk about in this, in their memo, is they say that Paul Hodgkins has several points where he made these key decisions along the way. One of those key points was in Florida when he packed up his bags and put some of the stuff into his bags that he would bring into the Capitol, some latex gloves, some goggles, things of that nature, basically preparing for battle. The second decision was after he left the rally, started making his way that 1.7 miles to the White House. And then the third decision was when he actually crossed those barriers and entered onto property that he had no right to be on, just as thousands of others did on January 6th. And then that next decision was entering the Capitol building. And the next decision after that was going into that Senate well. And that's what sort of escalated his sentence above and beyond above and beyond what a lot of other defendants are facing who entered the Capitol and are only facing misdemeanor charges. But because he entered that well of the Senate during that sort of extraordinary, shocking visual scene that we saw unfold inside the Senate chamber, that's really what escalated these charges and why he's one of the felony defendants in this sprawling investigation.
Well, and Clint, obviously, the closer he got to any senators or members, the graver danger he represented. I want to ask you about something that you can sort of surmise from the prosecutor's written sort of filings and ask you about this. Special Assistant U.S. Attorney Mona Segke cited in Hodgkins' FBI Director Ray's testimony in March at the Senate, the problem of homegrown violent extremism is metastasizing. She also asked the judge to recognize prior court filings, that though individuals convicted of such behavior may have no criminal history, she believes it makes them unique among criminals in the likelihood of recidivism. Now, obviously, being a repeat offender who has no criminal history speaks to this theory of the case that they have been radicalized and they're now extremists. How do you sort of keep them in a way with these prosecutions and sentencing that they don't represent a threat?
Yeah, it's going to be challenging, Nicole. And unfortunately, we kind of have to fall back on some of the lessons learned of the war on terror and kind of the spectrum. You know, we used to always say you're introduced to the ideology or the big lie. You're immersed in it. You become frustrated that, you know, the lie isn't becoming true. And then you mobilize essentially to violence. And I think what you're going to see is a spectrum of these actors and those that have already been arrested, and judges trying to adjudicate the severity and where they really are falling on that spectrum. So these first ones are going to come through. They're folks that are completely committed to a fantasy, but actually took overt action and are not likely connected to a larger plot or a larger conspiracy. Separately, you're starting to see some of these folks start to take plea arrangements or start to deal essentially with the federal government for reduced sentence. And that to me tells me they're cooperating for what are larger charges to come. Outside of that, Nicole, what we saw in San Francisco with the FBI making that arrest regarding the DNC, this is exactly what I was worried about 6 months ago. There are some that now see this is the moment where we need to commit. We need to accelerate. We need to bring this conflict to the fore. And that if we do this, if we do one single attack, we might inspire others to do it, or we might inspire our entire movement to follow us. I would just like to note that was the same theory used by terrorists 20 years ago.
And let me just, for our viewers, leave you with the extremists in their own words, lest you have any doubt that they're all taking their signals from the ex-president. Copeland, let's see what Trump is going to do. Rogers, he needs our help. Copeland, I know. Rogers, the deep state is disgusting. Rogers, two men change the world if we want to. Copeland, we don't need to win over 50,000 people. We need 500 pissed off patriots that want America back. So, as we say every day, here we are. Ryan Riley, Clint Watts, thank you so much for talking us through it today. The next hour of Deadline White House starts after a quick break. Don't go anywhere. We're just getting started.
The cold, hard truth is that what happened on January 6th can happen again. I fear, like many of you do, that the violence we saw on that terrible day may be just the beginning. Senators, this cannot be the beginning. It can't be the new normal. It has to be the end.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in the East. Look around and there are signs everywhere that we as a country are barreling towards what Congressman Joe Neguse warned all of us about during the ex-president's second impeachment trial, the possibility of another insurrection. Just this week, we got a stark reminder that domestic violent extremism is the greatest threat to the homeland. We told you how federal prosecutors cited the ongoing threat of domestic terrorism and their call for an 18-month prison term for the first felony defendant in the Capitol insurrection. And two men were charged in a plot to blow up the Democratic Party headquarters in Sacramento, California. All of this painting a picture of a fraught security situation, complicated by right-wing propaganda and disinformation, and a disgraced ex-president with fantasies and delusions of returning to power. Many people feared will do anything to overturn the results of the election he lost decisively. The New Yorker is reporting that in the final days of the Trump presidency, General Mark Milley feared that Trump would resort to conflict, either at home or abroad, after the 2020 election. There were two nightmare scenarios, Milley told associates, for the period after the November 3rd election, which resulted in Trump's defeat, but not his concession. One was that Trump would try to use the military on the streets of America to prevent the legitimate peaceful of power. The other was an external crisis involving Iran. It was not public at the time, but Milley believed that the nation had come very close to conflict with the Islamic Republic. The New Yorker today also describing this chilling final interaction between Milley and Trump before the insurrection. Trump brought up the forthcoming rally of his supporters on January 6th, asking Milley and the acting defense secretary, Chris Miller, if they were prepared for what Trump had already promised on Twitter would be a wild protest. It was a short conversation, Milley later recalled to associates, no more than a couple of minutes at the end of an hour-long meeting. Quote, it's going to be a big deal, Milley heard Trump say. You're ready for that, right? It was the last time the president would ever speak to his Joint Chiefs chairman. Combine these new details with what we just learned from Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker's upcoming book about Trump's deeply autocratic tendencies, and it's all the more alarming that the GOP is doing the bidding of the disgraced ex-president by continuing to peddle his big lie, by whitewashing the horrors of the insurrection and blocking any and all attempts at accountability for those who played a role in the attack. Add to that their push for voter suppression measures, and you have a real, well, Trump would say a beauty. Historian Tim Snyder warns the Washington Post's Dana Milbank of a full-blown constitutional crisis after the next election. Quote, we're looking almost certainly at an attempt in 2024 to take power without winning election. Recent moves in Republican-controlled state legislatures to suppress the votes of people of color and to give the legislatures control over casting electoral votes are all working toward the scenario in 2024 where they lose by 10 million votes, but they still appoint their guy. This existential threat to our democracy posed by the ex-president and his party is where we begin this hour with some of our favorite friends. Pete Strzok is here, former FBI counterintelligence agent and author of the book Compromised. Also joining us, Basil Smigel, Democratic strategist, former executive director of the New York State Democratic Party, now a lecturer at Columbia University. And Miles Taylor is here, former chief of staff for the Department of Homeland Security, now the co-founder of the Republican Political Alliance for Integrity and Reform. Miles, Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker's book tell a story that you've been telling since you first wrote an op-ed as anonymous in the New York Times. The people around the president were the most alarmed by the president, even more so than those of us watching from the outside. What do you make of the fact that all of your collective actions of not invoking the 25th Amendment, not going to more whistleblowers in Congress, brought us to the to where we are now with our democracy seriously imperiled by him?
Yeah, well, Nicole, the silence that some people had through the administration put this country through hell. There's no question. And I would say that the only penance those people can have is to now at least start speaking the truth, even though it's too late, because these strains of authoritarianism are continuing. So those cabinet secretaries that told me behind the scenes they felt like I did that Trump was a threat to the fabric of our republic, they still have an obligation to speak out. And I think it's morally disgusting that a lot of these people haven't. And I hate to be the guy that said, I told you so, Nicole, but you know, in my book, A Warning, I said, even if he loses the election, he's going to claim he didn't, and there's going to be violence. That was a year before the election. And why did I think that? Because I had heard Trump talk in person about using his authorities in a way that was extrajudicial. For instance, he talked about things in the Oval Office like martial law, and he talked to us explicitly about his fascination with the Insurrection Act. I have to hone in on that point. I've heard Donald Trump on multiple occasions in private, in the Oval Office, wax poetic about the use of the Insurrection Act. In those cases, it was to seal the border. But he knew he had this tool and this power. So I have no doubt in my mind that Trump, when inciting those protests, knew he potentially would have the ability to say there was an insurrection and try to deploy the military. That's not a fantasy. It was something that we were actually worried about.
You know, Pete Strzok, when you hear Miles talk about the situational awareness inside the highest levels of the ex-president's cabinet, and you think about this new reporting from Susan Glasser today in The New Yorker and from Carol Lenig and Phil Rucker over the past few days, it is not a comfort that at the end of the day, we have President Biden, the rightful winner of the 2020 election. It feels like that, too, is part of our slide toward normalizing all of the destruction that the ex-president did. And I wonder if you can just speak to your current assessment of the strength of the institutions and how much of this they can handle. Can they take four more years on the streets of looking for a plot like the one that was foiled in Sacramento? Can they take four more years of people radicalized by the big lie, radicalized by COVID restrictions, as it appears we're not done with COVID either? I mean, how much more of this can our institutions take?
Well, Nicole, I'm really worried about the threat that's out there, particularly when you look at what's already on the plate of the Department of Justice and the FBI and the other members of the intelligence community. I mean, keep in mind, you talked at the start about a couple of these folks who are finally beginning to plead out, but over 500 individuals have already been charged and looking at potentially another 100 or more who stormed the Capitol. So as the FBI, as DHS, as all these other government entities go out and try and build an intelligence base to understand what's coming, they aren't doing that from a starting point of nothing else on their plate. They have this enormous burden of taking all of these cases to trial, of developing evidence, of turning over evidence, of building a case, of scheduling all the various arguments, many of which are going to be very complicated in terms of arguing the First Amendment. These aren't simple trials. And so when you put all of that together and ask that the FBI and others lean forward and get ahead of the threat that's coming and is only increasing, I'm extraordinarily worried, because the FBI has always has more threats than it can handle. And when you look at this burgeoning, increasing domestic terrorism threat, I'm really worried about it.
You know, Basil, I never say anything about the Democratic Party in the spirit of these things being their fault. I say them in the spirit of, we as a country only have one party that is interested in governing and protecting the country. And I wonder what your assessment is of their bandwidth for dealing with now having to do a select committee to investigate January 6th because a commission wasn't something that Kevin McCarthy could sell to Donald Trump, and sort of doing all the governing and also having to push back against 389 voter suppression laws racing through 48 states. I mean, what is your assessment of the priorities they've chosen and how they're doing?
Well, I think that their choice of priorities is important, and it's certainly, I think, in the proper order as I would see it. But I would tell you, my concern really isn't for Congress. My concern is for the average American. You know, I got into public service because I was concerned, you know, I was concerned that history was always written by the winners. I'm spending my career now making sure it's not being written by the losers. The prevarication that's involved, the venue shopping, the fact that you have people all over the country, leaders all over the country, looking for the easiest, quickest possible pathway to undermine our government, undermine our election, undermine our democracy. And I said this last year when the Trump administration and his colleagues and the lawyers were going into the courts to say, you know, this election is invalid. It really wasn't just about that election. It's about testing the waters for all of these voter suppression laws that we're seeing that you just talked about. And, you know, I tell my students this, I tell others this all the time, that the burden on the individual is so intense to try to right these wrongs, to try to advocate, to try to mobilize. So I believe that Congress is doing the right thing. I think, and I'd like to feel confident that they have the bandwidth to tackle all of these issues. I am afraid that important policy isn't going to get done, but I have to say that hats off to the Biden administration because they've been able to push through, into Senator Schumer and others that have been able to push through very valuable pieces of legislation. But it's the average citizen that I am most concerned about. I don't want us to get tired. I don't want us to feel like it's too big for us to tackle all at once. We are all sort of deputized to do this.
Basil, I'm going to need you to say more because you've stirred something in me. And I look, democracy is a lead, really not easy to articulate how to start there. But that's what's happening. And I wonder if you, with your students, do you remain hopeful about democracy? Do you remain hopeful that they will have the same access to vote as we had in 2020? Do you remain hopeful that the forces that are pushing against facts and science and truth are going to lose? Are going to win, that the ones pushing those forces are going to lose?
I'm hopeful because of the students that I see, but by the time they get to me, that's not really what my concern is. I'm concerned about when they're younger. And I say that because this conversation around critical race theory, I think, is important, and I think it's valuable, and we should have it. What I am also concerned about, maybe even more so, is that we don't teach civics in schools the way we used to. So by the time the students see me, they're engaged, they want to be advocates, and I'm glad and anxious to train the next generation of advocate. But if they're not getting those lessons in K-12 education, they don't understand how this system works, the three branches of government, why they're important, how you access them. If you don't do that, then we've already lost. So that's one of the things that I fight for, and I encourage everybody else to as well.
Miles, you've been increasingly blunt. You're a blunt guy. You've been even blunter lately about the Republican Party as a threat to what Basil just described. People, by the time they get to him, really knowing the truth of the history of our country, the glorious and the not so glorious, as well as what we've been talking about for the last hour and 15 minutes, the increasing evidence that many members of the Republican Party have been radicalized to violence.
Yeah. And Basil, I like you a lot. And your optimism is, I usually try to be Mr. Brightside, but I'm pretty cynical on this one. And I've got to say, the reason being, I watched up close in the Trump administration, us going from having a so-called axis of adults that was trying to keep things in check. By the end, the axis of adults became a cabinet of cowards. And that cowardice spread faster than COVID-19 among Republicans, who ended up really aggressively aiding and abetting these efforts to undermine our democracy. I know a member of Congress from North Carolina who, after the insurrection, said that night, "I'm going to impeach Donald Trump tomorrow," then got weak in the knees the next morning because he didn't want to stray from the team. This is what we're worried about. And I actually think that the civil war within the Republican Party has gone from figurative to physical, We now have these physical threats, these terror plots we've been talking about around the country. In my own case, I had to hire a bodyguard because I spoke out against the president. I had a friend who recently spoke out against Trump have a hit put on their head and was notified by federal authorities of a hit on their head. So this is getting serious. It's serious. It's violent. It's scary. And the only way to get past it is we've got to go defeat the radicals at the ballot box. That's why we launched the Renew America movement. But I'm going to say, when it comes to the GOP civil war, there is a North and there is a South. And right now, the South is winning, and Americans need to stand up and arm the North in that struggle, arm the rationals to get these guys out of our politics, because I do sincerely think it's the greatest national security danger to the United States. I don't say that lightly. Peter worked on a lot of these cases alongside us when he was at the FBI. We looked at Russians and Chinese and terrorists. This is more serious than those threats that we were trying to stare down. And that's not hyperbole.
Well, let me just pour a little salt in this wound you've opened. I mean, I think it got serious for small children in cages 4 years ago. I think it got serious for those of us who spoke out against Trump lonely, few of us in 2016 and didn't take jobs in his cabinet, Miles. I mean, I think I welcome you to this fight. It is better with you in it. But there are a lot of people who've been sounding the alarm and have been, frankly, horrified that we're, it seems that there are fewer and fewer people joining the fight. That there, I'm not sure that I would describe the Republican Party as racked by a civil war. I think the Republican Party is brainwashed in its loyalty to Donald Trump. And I mean, Liz Cheney couldn't exist in its leadership ranks for refusing to lie. I mean, where is the friction?
Yeah, look, that's a good point. I mean, the North here, I don't want to portray it as a fair fight, is severely losing. We're talking about a ragtag crew that's trying to bring the GOP back from crazy. And I'm pretty cynical about the ability to do that in the near term. But I want to touch on something that you just said, because there's been a lot of rhetoric, including from these stories about General Milley, about Trump and Trump's policies being Nazi-like. I don't think that's a stretch at all. I mean, Miles Taylor 4 years ago would have rolled his eyes at that. But I saw it up close and personal with my own eyes. Policies like family separation at the border, the president's restrictive anti-immigration policies, these were genuinely Nazi-like restrictive efforts to try to close down our country and exercise his authorities in a way that, again, was extrajudicial. And in some cases, we determined to be illegal. So I don't think that's a stretch at all that General Milley saw this as a potential Reichstag moment. That's who Donald Trump is. And that's what we got very close to.
And you know, Pete, how do you fight that? I mean, what we are dealing with, I mean, Clint Watts described the scene in the streets of Philadelphia when they were marching over 4th of July weekend as, you know, this is also an advancement in terms of what they're willing to look like, dressed in their matching brown, you know, pants and whatever. I mean, we are so numb to how bad it is, because I think for some people it's been going on for so long. President Biden prevailed. But how do you deal with the fact that this has become normal on the political right?
I think you have to have some sort of accountability, because otherwise the narrative just, it's already been changed. I think part of the reason all these news stories are so shocking is we have forgotten the events of January 6th. We've heard so much of the right-wing propaganda machine trying to rewrite the narrative. And so when we see these new books coming out, they remind us of just what happened. But look, it is like fighting an Islamic terrorist threat. It goes not just to identifying the perpetrators and the wrongdoing, but then you have to hold them accountable and then go and start telling the truth of what actually happened. And when you look at what's going on with Liz Cheney, when people like, you know, Senator Mitt Romney, they are not being embraced by the Republican Party. The things they have to say are not being listened to by the bulk of the members of Congress on the Republican Party. So we've got to have a combination of vigorous enforcement and putting the truth out that is going to come out through these enforcement actions to try and get through to the average man and woman on the street that there's a real, real problem here, and we ignore it at our peril.
You know, Basil, I wonder how that lands with you, because I know there are people, and I hear this from my viewers, I hear this from Democratic sources, I hear this from other reporters. There are people who have been screaming at the top of their lungs since before Miles became anonymous. Democrats have found the smoking gun, not once, but in two impeachment trials against Donald Trump. They proved the facts were not in question for either of his two impeachment trials. he was let off the hook both times. The Mueller report in the first volume makes abundantly clear that Russian President Vladimir Putin and his acolytes and the Trump campaign had a shared mission. The obstruction section proves six acts of criminal obstruction of justice. The headline in every paper was totally and completely exonerated. I mean, what is your sort of, are you tapped out in terms of your well of confidence that the facts will prevail, or do you have hope that there will be accountability?
Tapped out? Not tapped out. I do wonder about accountability. This is owing to points that were made earlier. It's not north south for me. It's just every day listening to my colleagues and my friends. You know, here in New York, I'm hearing more of my African American friends say that they're interested in buying guns. It's got to that point when the everyday person is afraid to walk down the street because they're concerned that someone's gonna pull the rug out politically. In terms of our institutions, pull the rug out from under them. They feel that that not only is their democracy being attacked, but their person is being attacked as well. That's how it felt to so many of us on January 6th. So to be honest, I don't know that we believe that persons in my sort of circle, that there is enough accountability that exists to really hold everybody's feet to the fire. There are concerns that our elections aren't really going to work for us when we want, you know, if we really want change. Unfortunately, this is what we have in this moment. And, you know, going back to a point I was making earlier, if we're going to train the next generation, if we're going to open people's ears and eyes to what's going on, we have to talk about what's working. We have to talk about what's not working. And maybe there's no party in that, right? Maybe there's no left or right or progressive or moderate in that. You know, I still stand for the Democratic Party, but when you have a lot of young people that don't believe in any party or not affiliated with any party with any in a substantial way, you still have to talk to them. You still have to come at them and say that this is not correct. And I do feel confident that we'll get there.
The pro-democracy party. I'm for that. Pete Strzok, Basil Smichel, Miles Taylor, thank you so much for starting us off this hour. I'm grateful to all three of you for having this very frank and important conversation. When we return, with new fears about the Delta variant and COVID cases on the rise, the largest county in the country is now reinstating its mask mandate. Not everyone in the medical community thinks that's the right move. We'll talk about that story next. Plus, as prosecutors swirl around Matt Gaetz, we're learning more about the kinds of people Gaetz is turning to for help. It's not pretty. And the one issue uniting the left and the right, free Britney. We'll talk about that. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
There is a clear message that is coming through. This is becoming a pandemic of the unvaccinated. We are seeing outbreaks of cases in parts of the country that have low vaccination coverage because unvaccinated people are at risk, and communities that are fully vaccinated are generally faring well.
A pandemic of the unvaccinated, as described today by the CDC director as the highly contagious Delta variant, has led to a startling rise in COVID cases, a nearly 70% jump in 1 week, with COVID hospitalizations and deaths on the rise again, too. But she says the more than 153 million fully vaccinated adults across the U.S. remain protected. Still, amid a recent rise in community transmission, Los Angeles County, the largest in the nation, is reviving precautions for everyone, bringing back its indoor mask mandate tomorrow for residents, regardless of their vaccine status. Let's turn to someone we trust, Dr. Erwin Redlener, professor of pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, founding director of the National Center of Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University, and an MSNBC public health analyst. Dr. Redlener, let me just start with the kinds of questions I get all the time. When will kids younger than 12 be able to get vaccinated if the parents want them to?
Yeah, so let's deal directly with that, Nicole. And that is going to happen sometime before the end of this year or maybe into early 2022. So any hopes for getting younger children vaccinated by school starting this fall is probably not realistic. But that's, I think, the timetable that we should expect.
So that said, is the Delta variant more dangerous to kids? Is that what you're seeing, these cases like what we have in Mississippi? Or is it more contagious, so anyone unvaccinated is more susceptible?
The latter is true. Anyone not vaccinated is definitely going to be more contagious. However, we're also watching a pretty concerning trend, Nicole, where we're having younger and younger people get sick with the Delta variant, and they're being admitted to the hospital. We're talking about people in their 20s and 30s. There's absolutely no reason to feel confident that it's going to stop there. And I think we're seeing an early warning sign in places like Mississippi, where officials are saying lots of children being admitted to the hospital are really quite sick. That is worrisome to me. It's not enough high enough number to make me go into panic mode, but I think it's just like an early warning, a shot across the bow here, that we cannot become too complacent about where this is all going, because we just don't know, Nicole. And the other thing is, even if children are not getting very sick, they also can become carriers, which makes people that they may live with or have contact with much more vulnerable to getting ill. So older people, people with immune compromise and so on, who are near these children who may be carriers, is a problem we need to be concerned about.
Can you talk about people who are vaccinated getting COVID and testing positive? I know there were some baseball players this week that tested positive. I mean, what is, can you get COVID after you're vaccinated?
You can, and there's some new data out of the United Kingdom that, in fact, is saying that they're seeing people who have been fully vaccinated getting, a round of COVID. And I think that that is also something to worry about. But the problem in the U.S., Nicole, is that we have such a crazy patchwork of places that are vaccinated, communities that, by and large, are not vaccinated. We have different rules and guidelines coming out in Los Angeles, as you just pointed out. It's nuts looking. You know, it's like we're looking at a map of a completely patchwork, random set of guidelines, of gubernatorial rulings about what's allowed and what's not allowed. Mm-hmm. And I think we look kind of nuts, I'm sorry to say, in a time when we're really re-entering a phase of exacerbation of this terrible pandemic of COVID-19.
Yeah, and look, I want to talk about that now. I mean, those are the political contours of our country. And I wanted to get the facts out there because I think we're still starved for information. We're still trying to make the best decisions about what our kids should be doing. We're still trying to make the best decisions about whether we're just going back to our pre-COVID lives in September. And I think what I hear you saying is maybe not so fast.
Yeah, not so fast. Here's the thing about this. So if we lived in Israel or the UK or France, there's a national policy, and that policy becomes the guidelines. It may change as conditions change. You know, we get new variants, and that may obviously affect the guidelines. Here, the CDC can make recommendations, establish guidelines, but there's essentially zero obligation for any state or even any city to strictly follow what's put out there. And that's a real problem. It's this disconnect between the science and the policy. We keep saying, well, we're going to be dependent on the science to make decisions. Well, not exactly. Maybe the CDC is, but the rest of the country is not obligated to follow along. So that's why we have such a disorganized, politicized set of agendas around getting the pandemic under control.
And it leaves us susceptible to what the president diagnosed today as Facebook killing people. Facebook has responded. I'm not going to read their whole thing, but they basically said, we will not be distracted by accusations which aren't supported by facts. The fact is more than 2 billion people have viewed authoritative information about COVID and vaccines on Facebook. I mean, the problem isn't the aren't the billions of people that looked at good information. The problem are these numbers. Let me put up the state by state vaccination rates. Tennessee, 47% of adults are vaccinated. 49% in South Carolina, 46% in Louisiana, 42% in Alabama, 54% in Kansas. I mean, the problem is, you know, the other close to 60% in some of these states are getting their disinformation from Facebook. And I wonder if you think that this White House and this administration being more aggressive with disinformation will save lives.
Well, I think it's been really incredibly irresponsible by those big social media platforms, especially Facebook. I really wish they would take control over this. You know, they are able to take control now, I guess, over allowing certain people to post. But I think we need a much better system of accountability by Facebook that is somehow assessing whether they're dealing with absolute let's call it, you know, BS or something resembling truth, because many people are 100% relying on Facebook to get their information, and much of it is just absolute informational garbage. And I think it's affecting the ability of America, really, to protect us from getting into a very serious new wave of COVID-19. It's a disaster for us.
I hit you, Dr. Redliner, with a lightning round. What do you, I want to give you the last word. Any thoughts about this moment?
Yeah, I think it really is time. I mean, I wrote an op-ed the other day, which caused me a lot of grief, but I said Joe Biden should call up Donald Trump, if he'll take his call, and tell him to please talk to his constituents, to his fan base, to his followers, whatever you want to call them, and tell them, beg them, for the sake of the country, to get vaccinated. You know, Donald Trump, his entire family got vaccinated. Donald Trump, with Operation Warp Speed, actually made it possible for Joe Biden to have an accelerated path to getting so many people vaccinated. One last thing that Trump could do right now to benefit America is to tell his followers, please get vaccinated. He used a lot of, I mean, I didn't agree with almost everything in his administration, but now it's time for him to step forward and do the right thing, I think, if he'll do it.
I totally agree with you. I think the president, it's worth going down to wherever the retired Floridian lives, Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah.
And I would add to that. I mean, I think if Fox News made this a mission statement for everyone eligible to talk to their doctor if they want to first and then get vaccinated, those are the two entities, yeah, the ex-president and Fox News, that could have the greatest impact. You look at the ratings, cable news ratings. Fox News has massive numbers of people watching their programs. They could save millions of lives if they wanted to. And the question is, do they want to?
Exactly right, Nicole. Answer. Saving lives. It's about saving. Yeah. Saving lives.
Only,
exactly.
Only they can answer it if they choose to. Dr. Redliner, thank you so much for answering all of our questions and spending some time with us. When we return, there are new details about Matt Gaetz and who and what he is spending big, big, big money on in the face of sex trafficking allegations against him. That reporting is next. New campaign finance reporting filed yesterday is giving us a little window into the depths of the troubles facing disgraced Congressman Matt Gaetz. That's excluding the federal sex trafficking investigation, where charges could be looming for him. According to filings with the FEC ahead of his bid for re-election, Gaetz has enlisted some of Trump world's most devoted followers. That includes Roger Stone, whose consulting firm was paid $20,000 by Gaetz' campaign. Perhaps most surprisingly, Gaetz' campaign paid $25,000 to a lawyer who lists Jeffrey Epstein as a notable client, Mark Furnick. The lawyer who's also represented El Chapo, of all people, says on his website that he specializes in, quote, subtle, novel, and creative arguments that other attorneys may miss. Joining us now, Nick Confessori, New York Times political and investigative reporter and an MSNBC contributor, and Katie Fang, NBC and MSNBC legal contributor. Katie, the Matt Gaetz story has been largely opaque to us. We know a lot through his former wingman, who just successfully got an extended period in which he won't be sentenced, ostensibly because he's proving fruitful as a witness and storyteller. What do you make of sort of that data point laid over where Matt Gaetz is spending his campaign money?
So, Nicole, you know, these campaign finance disclosures, they come out after the conclusion of each quarter. So we wrapped up the end of June, and by July 15th, which is yesterday, these candidates are required to disclose how they've been spending their money. So as a lawyer, I'm focusing on two major things that have come out at this disclosure. One, the $25,000 being paid to Mark Furnick. What do you need a criminal defense attorney for unless you're concerned about criminal exposure? And when you have something like campaign finance money, it's supposed to be used for services or for things that are being provided that are related to your campaign. So Matt Gaetz, you're hiring a criminal defense attorney. You're paying him $25,000 by no coincidence. He happened to represent people like Jeffrey Epstein and this recent guy, Keith Raniere, who was running a sex cult. But is it related to your campaign? Because, Nicole, if those funds were used and they were not related to his campaign, then he's created an FEC problem. So he's kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. If he's making it a disclosure, then it has to be related to his campaign. But what does flying on a private jet to the Bahamas with underage girls have anything to do with your campaign, Matt? Well, those are the questions that are being raised. The second thing very quickly is the following. If you're paying Roger Stone money for some type of campaign consultant advice, well, you're making two of those payments, Matt, to his company being Roger Stone's company, Drake Ventures, which has been sued by the federal government for acting as an alter ego for Roger Stone and his wife for fraudulent transfers. So everything looks kind of dirty and none of it seems clean at all.
Well, let me follow up with you, Nate Commissary, on that point, because we know, we learned back in April that the Daily Beast, and I believe the Times had some reporting on this too, that Greenberg, who is Gates' wingman, who has been charged and is awaiting sentencing, enlisted Stone last fall to secure a pardon from Donald Trump. I mean, what Stone does is isn't really clearly campaign consulting, as Katie, I think, is insinuating. Let me read you some more of this reporting. According to a series of text messages between the two men, Greenberg repeatedly told Stone that Gates was directly implicated in the same-sex crimes he had been charged with earlier that year. So is it reasonable to think that one of the things that is at least available to federal prosecutors or under scrutiny is sort of this triangle between the three of them around a pardon?
Look, it's possible. I was thinking a different thought, Nicole. You know, I saw that story and the Times story back when the Gates effort to get a pardon from Trump back in the day was first reported. But in light of paying Roger Stone and paying all these different associates of the president, it seems to me that who knows who will be president in 3 or 4 years and who will be in office then. And that's why it makes a lot of sense. If you're betting on Donald Trump perhaps being president again, and you think that the option of a pardon could be open in the future, it makes a lot of sense for both short-term political purposes in his campaign and long-term purposes to ingratiate yourself as closely as you can. And in particular, put on your payroll a guy who is quite an expert in getting a pardon from Donald Trump for taking flack for him.
We have a philosophical difference of opinion, Nick Confessori, that these people play long games like chess. I think they play whack-a-mole, but to be continued. I'm going to ask both of you to stick around, because when we return, in a hyper-partisan universe, there's one issue that unites both sides. Free Britney. That story's next. Britney Spears has a right to choose her own attorney for the very first time in 13 years. This week, the judge overseeing the conservatorship approved the hiring of former federal prosecutor Matthew Rosengart after the pop star spoke publicly for the second time this month in an emotional appeal by phone that her father be removed and charged with conservatorship abuse. Spears told the court this, quote, "The conservatorship has allowed my dad to ruin my life." Spears also managed to do something not even a capital insurrection that threatened to destroy our democracy could do, uniting both sides of the political aisle from Ted Cruz to Elizabeth Warren, calling out to free Britney. Republican Congresswoman Nancy Mace even tweeting, quote, "It's insane. You can force a woman to basically sterilize herself under the guise of protection. If this is happening to Britney Spears, how many other women across the country are silently suffering?" We're back with Nick Confessori and Katie Fang. Nick, it is your paper who I think brought a lot of Britney's story and the Free Britney movement to a wider audience with the documentary about all of her fans and about some of the legal machinations around the conservatorship. Talk about these most recent developments and now I believe a former clerk to someone who went on to be a Supreme Court justice is her new and we're told aggressive attorney.
Right. Well, look, I'm so proud of my colleagues for making this story one that really jumped out to people around the country and more importantly, highlighted this bigger issue of the abuse of these conservatorships. They are poorly overseen. They are ripe for abuse. There are cases in which there are conservators who come in and basically take over someone's life and steal from them. It's been a growing issue around the country, and it's tragic but not surprising that it required this happening to a celebrity, a household name, to bring this kind of out in the open a little more. What we're seeing here, I think, is the fruit of this publicity, this positive publicity, and efforts by Britney Spears herself to get more control over her life. I also think that Now, the reason you see someone like Nancy Mace or Ted Cruz jump out on this is first of all, obviously, it tears at your heartstrings to think of this person suffering and being not free. But also this question of the forced sterilization, the IUD, you know, if she isn't able to control her own birth control, that really lights up, I think, people across the spectrum, but especially social conservatives. And so you have a moment here to ask this basic question of what is the purpose of this conservatorship? Whose interest is it really serving to have Britney Spears be a cash cow for her dad, for some managers, or for some so-called advisors? And is it really serving Spears' interests?
You know, I mean, Katie Fang, is this heading toward a criminal investigation of her father and the conservatorship?
Well, you know, I think it's kind of too early to tell, although to have Britney Spears say that she wants her father charged is obviously, you know, pretty shocking, and that is her father. But as you mentioned, Matthew Rosengart, who's a former federal prosecutor who now has represented some pretty big names in Hollywood and is at a large law firm, he has the manpower and the resources to be able to be the voice for Britney Spears now and to be able to give her the opportunity to be heard. But his critical next move is going to be to see whether or not Britney Spears' father will stipulate and agree to have this conservatorship be terminated. In the absence of that agreement, he's going to file a petition to terminate that conservatorship. And during the course of that evidentiary hearing, Nicole, we're going to see the presentation of perhaps fraud, the presentation of medical evidence that shows that Britney has not been suffering in terms of not having the capacity to have free agency over herself, her body, and her money. And we may see an accounting of the funds where truly it peels back the layers of what's been happening. There's no more mystery involved in terms of what was happening to her money. And to Nick's point, everybody was feeding at the trough of Britney Spears. Everybody was using her and parading her out with no problems to be able to generate this money. And now when she says, I want to take over my life again, I want to be back in the driver's seat, really should her father be balking? I mean, there was some erratic activity, but it was back in 2007 and 2008. This was always intended to be a temporary conservatorship. And the fact that 13 years later, we're having this conversation is a sad reality. There are 1.3 million people, according to the last amount of data that we've been able to see, that are under guardianships or conservatorships, but there's $5 billion in assets that are under the control of guardians and conservators. And so there's a lot at risk for both sides in this case.
Well, Nick, I mean, that raises the obvious question. Was this about taking care of Britney, or was this about taking Britney's money?
I think that's what we're going to find out in the coming weeks and months. If the court case continues, if the petition to get rid of the conservatorship is denied, and we start seeing some of these details more in the press, more in court first and then in the press, I think we'll have to find out who sets the fees, who decided on the royalties, who decided how much of a cut different people get. Was Britney Spears allowed to decide any of that? Was this all being done over her head? And what you get from the documentary and from other reporting is a picture of a woman who is an adult, who posed no risk to herself or to others, who is performing constantly in Las Vegas, who wasn't allowed to make any decisions for herself. And yet somehow she's able to perform every night and have a show out there and be a cash cow.
It's insane. It is an insane story. We'll stay on it. Nick Confessori, Katie Fang, thank you both so much for spending some time with us, especially on a Friday. We'll be back after a short break. Don't go anywhere. I know the world is still a daunting place, but if you're vaccinated and you know how to stay safe and you happen to be in the neighborhood, there's one more reason to visit Paris. The Eiffel Tower reopened today after a 9-month shutdown because of the coronavirus pandemic. This morning, visitors cheered and celebrated when the landmark reopened after its longest closure since the Second World War. Visitors over 18 are required to show either proof of vaccination or a negative COVID test. Those under 11 are required to wear a mask. It's just a little sign, a symbol that the world is slowly and carefully getting back to normal. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. Let me apologize again for our technical difficulties at the beginning of the last hour. We're grateful to you for watching.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.